Margie is going to get up from behind the piano and bring our reading this morning. Thanks, Margie.
The reading is from Hebrews chapter 11, verse 12 to 16. And so from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and as countless as the sand on the seashore. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks, Margie. So it's 2024, you may be very aware, and it's going very fast, a year of some big events this year, one of them being the next general election. At some point, probably not too far from now, there will be an announcement of the next general election, and then we will start the merry-go-round of hustings and prospective MPs declaring that their policy is the right answer for our country today. And one of the hot topics for this election would be, I think you probably agree, would be immigration or the right of citizenship. For we observe concerns about citizenship on all sides of society and the wide political spectrum. Our political leaders debate issues of border security and the need for people from other countries to get legal permission to live and to work here and the way and how this is done. Travellers face greater scrutiny everywhere, and we are met with distressing images, like we were just this week, of desperate people trying to cram into unseaworthy boats. I use the word boat loosely, with deadly consequences. Now, unstable governments, porous borders and desperate refugees create awful living conditions for millions of people around the world. But none of this is new. See, none of this is new. The question of belonging to a community in a familiar location is old as civilization. And the image of a wanderer in a place that is unwelcoming is central to the message of the Bible. In fact, it's Jesus' story. The story of the eternal Son's journeying into his creation, being rejected at birth and dying alone on a cross, abandoned by his friends. And Jesus said of himself, "The foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to rest his head." So, we are studying Hebrews chapter 11. We're on the fourth sermon already of that. Stories of faith, we're calling this. And Hebrews 11, it recalls a number of stories of Old Testament saints and their experience of faith so that then that we can learn from them to have faith. And the account of Abraham and Sarah, it's the longest of these in Hebrews 11. 12 verses, in fact, even a bit more if you go in more into the story of Isaac and the sort of patriarchal family coming from Abraham. So it's a big chunk. And I'm really grateful for Reg last week for sort of doing some of the heavy lifting in the story and introducing us to the story of Abraham and Sarah. And that idea that was introduced, that Abraham and Sarah's story is that they lived in tents in the land where God had called them to be, and that is that they lived as outsiders in that land. And verse 8 of our reading last week focused on Abraham's obedience to God's command, "Go to the land which I will show you," from Genesis 12. And if we are Christians, I think we will have heard a similar word from Jesus himself. You know, if anyone wishes to come to me, come after me, they must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Christian life can be described as a journey. I've used that metaphor a few times, just a couple of weeks ago, talking about journey. You know, we leave the past, we take up our cross, and we follow the one who calls us. But our new world is not one of ease and safety. And we often find ourselves living in the midst of people who are antagonistic to Jesus and don't understand what motivates us. And we have opportunities and responsibilities that go along with being sojourners. Now, sojourners is an interesting word. It's not a word I use often in my conversations, to be quite frank with you. But I say it because I was listening to Reg last week and he mentioned it two or three times. And I thought I'd just talk about it. It's a Hebrew term. You may be familiar with it, but it's a Hebrew term, and its translation conveys the basic idea that a person or a group is living either temporarily or permanently in a community in a place which is not primarily their own and is dependent on the goodwill of that community for their continued existence. So that's what a sojourner means. And because the story of Abraham and Sarah is so central to the message of Hebrews 11, I just want to briefly go out and review a couple of things that we focused on last week. First, an observation that I think is central to the story of Abraham and Sarah, that God's ways are not our ways. It's central to our life, really, isn't it? But God's ways are not our ways. Verse 11 made the point that they were allowed to bear and raise a child, but the promised child came much later than anybody could have reasonably expected, even beyond the time when it was physiologically possible for them to have children. Then the other thing concerns living as aliens in a place that God assigns, a place where there is mystery, confusion, uncertainty, and difficulty. You know, it turns out that it would be impossible to grow as a Christian if we were allowed to live behind the walls of the city made up only of people like us, where our every decision was cheered, where it's easy to follow the Lord and do what is right, where good choices are always rewarded and bad ones punished. No, it's only in the darkness that we can bear witness to the light. You hear that? It's only in the darkness that we can bear witness to the light. And then there's a third idea in the text from last week that leads us into today's passage, a kind of overlap, really, and which I want you to go a bit deeper with this morning. It's this, it's Abraham and Sarah were looking for something more. Verse 10, for he was looking forward to the city where, with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. The life of faith makes us long for what we do not yet have. It makes us realize that we were made for something that this world cannot offer to us. It opens our hearts to the possibilities of beauty and connectedness and love that relationships in this physical world will never be able to supply. Let me read again. Margie read really well, but it was just a few verses. Just going to read, in fact, Margie read from verse 12, which was a kind of overlap because 13 doesn't make a lot of sense without 12. But I'll read from verse 13 to 16 and just then explain a little bit about these verses. So, all these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. And therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. I love that. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Almost every point throughout Hebrews 11, when a new idea is introduced, we get that phrase, by faith Enoch, by faith Noah, by faith Abraham, Moses, etc. But in this paragraph, that phrase doesn't appear. Here the author has kind of stepped back, realizing there is a problem that needs to be dealt with, and the problem is death. God made promises to Abraham and Sarah, sending them on a journey, and some of the expected outcomes, for example, Isaac's birth, were realized, but they soon died before the story was over. So not all of the promises were fulfilled. So our author here is raising a question: does death cancel the promises? Did God give up on Abraham and Sarah? But reflecting on the fact that the family of Abraham died, the author says exactly the opposite, that death is actually the doorway that leads us to the great gifts that this life can't provide. All the possibilities to which our hearts have been awakened in this life will be fulfilled in the life to come. I think there's three concepts here in these few verses that I think will help us think about this deeper. The first concept is this, that the refusal of the patriarchal families to go back. Although they could have done so, they refused to go back. They didn't turn back. And Abraham left Ur in Mesopotamia. It was wealthy, it was a fertile region with an advanced culture. Abraham was called to leave that city and go into the pastures and the hills of Canaan. And we know from Genesis chapter 12 that he sojourned for a while in Egypt and he saw the great cities of the Pharaoh's kingdom. And Abraham and Sarah could have left that journey that they were on and went back to the life they had before, but they rejected that idea. You know, people like us don't go back either. Why is it when the Christian journey gets hard and confusing, why don't we just give up saying, you know, I've done with this. Following Jesus doesn't work for me anymore. I'm getting off this narrow road and I'm going onto a broad road. Doing that seems to make sense for a lot of people, so why not me? I'm going to find a way of living which is more focused on me and less attentive to God. You know, in our honesty, in our life of faith, who have not felt that for a few seconds maybe? This is just too hard. I think it would be easier if I concentrated on me instead of God. Maybe. It's a thought that some have. Well, there's a reason that we don't do that. The patriarchal families didn't do that either. And it's because going back is not so much a matter of geography anymore, but the breaking of a relationship. Going back means we lose intimacy with the one who called us on the journey. The reason Abraham was in the promised land was because when God said to him to go there, he said, I will go there as your companion along the way. So going back means we kind of lose and leave the presence of God. Now, however chaotic and hard to understand how life is in God's presence, we just can't imagine living it without him. The Gospels record the story of the feeding of the 5,000, and we're all very familiar with that. I know it's one of the great miracles of the New Testament, when a large crowd had gathered and Jesus feeds them all with a child's loaf and fishes, and people are astonished at the miracle. And then when Jesus leaves, a great multitude gets up and follows him the next day. And Jesus talks to these people who are beginning to follow him as his disciples, and he challenges them, saying the reason that you are following me is not that you're interested in God, it's you're interested in the food that I'm providing you. And after saying that, a great many of them departed from Jesus. And then Jesus asked the original 12 disciples with him, says, you don't want to do that also, do you? You don't want to go, do you? And then Peter says something interesting. He says, Lord, to whom shall we go? For you have the words of eternal life. You can read in between the lines, and he's basically saying, to be honest, Jesus, that it might be easier if we could depart, but we can't, because you have the words of eternal life. If we go back, we lose Jesus' presence. And if we leave him now, we leave life itself. We can't do that. We can't do that. Second concept that helps us in this text is that of the city of God. Hebrews 13:14, which is a bit further on, says that it's a lasting city. In verse 10 from last week, we were told this city was the one with a strong foundation, whose architect and builder is God. Because the family of Abraham had to live in tents while other people around them lived in cities. But part of what is being taught here is the idea that even the most durable building or the most permanent city in this world will not last forever. Consider the temple of the Jews. When they wandered in the wilderness, they worshipped in a tent, didn't they? The tabernacle. And then they were finally permitted to build a temple, but then the temple was destroyed, so they rebuilt it. And what happened? The temple again was destroyed. And Abraham watched Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities on the plain, get destroyed by fire from heaven. So the most permanent dwellings in this world are only temporary. The most secure environment, the most powerful army, the best defended borders, not one of them can last. But there is a city that has foundations, that this is made by God, that will last. Another thing about the city of God that we should think about is that phrase right at the end of our reading, the last two words of verse 16, it says, for them. God has prepared it with his children in mind. That means you. Perhaps you have built a house. I'm looking around. I'm not sure if any of you have actually built a house. You might have done, built your own house, or certainly remodeled or done some serious work on a house. And sometimes people think if we could just design and build our dream home, it would be perfect. And of course, when you get into your dream house, it is not perfect. Some things still don't work quite how you want them to be. Great ideas that were great at the beginning turn out to be not so. Our preferences change over time, and it's not suited exactly to the things that we thought it would be, even though we made it. But there is a dwelling made for us by the one who knows us better than we know ourselves. Jesus said in the night before he died, recorded in John's Gospel, he said, my Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have told you that I am going there to prepare a place for you? If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, and also where I also may I be where, so that also you may be where I am. Got there in the end. There is a sense that what is awaiting us in the future is the best possible place for us. It lasts forever. It's exactly suited for us. All the things that we have hoped for, longed for, dreamed of are being prepared for us. But there's another side of that coin too. In fact, it's more important. It's the fact that we are being prepared for it. And also, but the emphasis is when Jesus says, I am going to prepare a place, it's the emphasis is on not on prepare, it's on going. It's in the going is the preparation, and the going involves the death and the rising of Jesus, the cross and the empty tomb. That's the going that prepares us, that enables us to enter. C.S. Lewis wrote an incredible book, you may have read it, called The Problem of Pain, and he wrote this very personal book about the grief he experienced at the loss of his wife, Joy. And many of you may, that movie Shadowlands with Anthony Hopkins in that movie. Beautiful, touching movie, but he wrote incredibly personally and powerfully about the grief he experienced in this book. And he wrote about this concept of being, of God going and preparing a house for us and preparing us for the house. And let me read a little bit. He says this. He says, imagine yourself as a living house. God comes to rebuild that house. And at first, perhaps, you can understand what he's doing. He's getting the drains right and he's stopping the leaks in the roof and so on. And you knew that those jobs needed doing, and so you're not surprised. But presently he starts knocking the house about in a way that hurts you abominably. And it doesn't seem to make sense. What on earth is he up to? The explanation is that he's building quite a different house from the one that you thought of. He's throwing out a new wing here. He's putting on an extra floor there. He's running up towers. He's making courtyards. You thought you were going to be made into a decent, nice little cottage. But he's building you into a palace because he wants to come and live in that palace. I love those words. Last thing about City of God that we should think about is this statement, therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, that he has prepared a city for them, that he is not ashamed. It means he regards them well. He believes in them. He loves them. It's a powerful thing to imagine that God is not just making a place for us, but he has a warm heart towards us. He welcomes us. He approves of us. He delights in us. I've got another story about a US president. I've got a whole bagload of stories about US presidents. It's quite an old one again. I don't, to be honest, know which president it relates to. But he comes to the USA on a ship. So it's probably a few years ago. So it's about a president returning to the USA on a ship. There was a great number of people around him, security and important political figures and so on. When the ship docked in New York City, of course there was an extraordinary fanfare with military guards and reporters taking pictures and a band playing Hail to the Chief. That's what they play, don't they, when John Napton returns from his journeys. and so on. But 10 decks down, on this same ship was a missionary couple tucked away in some tiny windowless cabin on this boat, returning after spending decades of their life serving God overseas, giving their life away for God's sake. They were the last ones off of the ship that day. And as they came down the gangway onto the dock, everybody else had left. No one had come to welcome them home. And the husband expressed frustration and sadness. He said, we have given our lives to God and there's not one person here to welcome us home. No one even knows. But his wife turned to him with all wisdom, the way wives do. And she said to him, there is a welcome waiting for us. We just aren't home yet. Isn't that? We're just not home yet. There is a welcome. Evelyn, there's a welcome waiting. We're just not home yet. Just not there yet. And we must realize there is also no way God could give us everything he has prepared for us here. There has to be another world, another place where things are different. And so our hopes grow stronger, our longings grow greater, yet our tears grow more frequent. We find ourselves wanting the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. The city that lasts forever. The city that he has prepared us for and for us. So the big question as we finished. So how will we live now? Will we live as faithful sojourners, anticipating the world to come? I want to close with Jesus' instructions on preparing for the world to come that we read in the Sermon on the Mount. And I ask you to reflect on these and pray about getting ready, not for this world, as if that would pay off, but for what is still to come. Let me read to you from Matthew's Gospel. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy, and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body or what you will wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. I want to close with a prayer. It's an old prayer written in 1577. John, I remember it. It was written by Sir Francis Drake, the great seafarer. Let me just be still and pray. The prayer reads this. disturb us, Lord, when we are too well pleased with ourselves, when our dreams have come true because we have dreamed too little, when we arrive safely because we sailed too close to the shore. Disturb us, Lord, when with the abundance of things we possess, we have lost our thirst for the waters of life. Having fallen in love with life, we have ceased to dream of eternity, and in our efforts to build a new earth, we have allowed our vision of the new heaven to dim. Disturb us, Lord, to dare more boldly, to venture on wider seas where storms will show your majesty. We're losing sight of land, we shall find the stars. And we ask you to push back the horizons of our hopes and to push into the future in strength, in courage, hope and love.